people are coming back to the seats, I'll just establish some motivational points for this panel. As you can see, this is dealing with the theory of wireless networks, and you can see that it's all about just the theory because we're using this cable here. And also, it's supposed the theory is what, 4:15? And in theory, we would have John Sylvester joining us, but he's joining us in theory. So, with that as the background for this panel, let me tell you, I'll give you some theoretical points, and I'll let my distinguished colleagues give you the real points as to what is a useful theory result. And like somebody said, depends on what the definition of this is. I still have to figure out what network theory is, and bottom line is we are trying to design and implement mechanisms, protocols, and architectures for new networks, wireless networks in particular, that go from the physical layer all the way to community networks or social networks. And to do so, we need to ask different type of questions to formulate the problem to begin with. And I would like to basically touch on three types of questions that I think are important, at least in theory. And one is the logic of the protocols and algorithms and mechanisms that we are designing. Are they correct? Do they have deadlocks? Do they do what they are supposed to do all the time? Or do we have problems? Second question is, what is the best that we could possibly do if we had the best hardware that we could possibly imagine, and we had the best protocols and architectures that we could dream of having? So there are some limits to what we can do, no matter what we do on the physical layer all the way up to the social network layer. And of course, we have to make choices and implement things, so we have to come a bit down to reality and then address the impact of specific hardware, specific protocol stacks or protocol modules, mechanisms, and ask questions regarding the performance of those specific instantiations of the things we want to implement. And typically we need to go by analytical models when the parameters that we have to deal with are too many to wait for simulations to complete, especially if they are in OpNet. Or we do simulations if the algorithms are really complex and the interactions between the physical layer and the algorithms are so complex that we cannot come up. We haven't been able to come up with the right analytical model yet. So it's a nice interplay of the two, but both are just models. So the value proposition, I think, in the theory is how it feedbacks back to what we're doing eventually and allows to build over time better and better systems. So with that motivation, that's why I'm giving you the theory, not the real reason that we were here today. So a useful theoretical result is really the usefulness of our result. The theoretical result is determined pretty much by the intent of the model that we're building. So I think it's not possible to model everything, because the model will be so complex that nobody will understand it. So we must be able to capture key aspects of the logic of the protocol, the limits that we are trying to investigate, or the performance of the particular algorithms or algorithm we are playing with. We don't actually have to model the real protocol as long as we can derive meaningful insight from our endeavor. And so we need to be able to translate what our model tells us to something that is implementable. And I'll keep this kind of motherhood and apple pie story shorter than usual. So I'll give you some good old examples that I'm hoping nobody will be offended or overly praised by that. So in terms of logic, nobody would design ARQ schemes based on window-based control by simply accepting packets whenever there is a buffer space. So we know that to be safe and alive, we need to do play with sequence numbering. So there is a lot that has been gained by all these proofs of ARQ protocols and algorithms in the past. So that's one example. In terms of performance, the Clanrock and student papers started kind of a paper publishing industry almost there. And using the Poisson approximation, hand waving with the magical secondary channel, which act just happened, we were able to, people were able to discuss Aloha CSMA, digital multiple access CSMACD, and on and on and on. And it's not to say that the CSMA will perform the way that Tobagi and Clanrock wrote in the 70s papers, but we know that if we do carrier sensing, we're going to do better than if we cannot do carrier sensing. If we do collision detection, we're going to do better than if we don't do collision detection, but because the bad BCPs are kept very tiny compared to the proportion of time during which we send good packets. So it is that insight that proved to be very useful, and the lesson has been carried on many, 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 probably hundreds of papers since the publication of Clanrock's work. Gallagher's necessary and sufficient conditions for optimal routing is another key example. Nobody would dream of trying to pretend to do routing on the basis of instantaneous knowledge of the topology and the traffic and everything. But it provides a clear upper bound that up to which we can measure how good our congestion-based routing schemes can do. And in fact, some of us have tried to do just that. In terms of limits, since key papers by Gupta Kumar and Gross-Lauser and Tse and many others, we have learned that about the overcapacity of networks when we don't embrace interference, multiple access interference, and more recently we have been trying to embrace interference because of the lessons learned from these capacity results. So, just keeping the clock ticking here. Some recent example. This is I give you this example because is the result. The paper is not really about anything to do with routing, but I managed to have an excuse to tie it to routing. So in this paper, is about the capacity of wireless networks when all the nodes have K receivers and. M of those K receivers receive the information M of those K receivers we get information correctly. And there are N nodes and everybody is the same. So it's kind of, and we are interested in the other capacity when at most one packet can be received at the receiver successfully at any given time. So the point I'm trying to make is not the details of the analysis, but the fact that we identify three regions in the performance or the order capacity of the network that pertain to the case in which the receivers of a node are in big data one or some number that is the multicast region or big data of n, when n is the number of nodes. So basically, what this tells us from the routing perspective is that if we are going to be really able to scale networks, we better be able to do signaling of the routing protocols that keeps as much as possible in this unicast or multicast range, meaning that we need to somehow manage to keep the signaling overhead of any routing scheme within regions of interest where the information is actually needed. If we have to float route requests or float link states or float routing table updates to everyone in the network, we're going to be in this region, and we had already cases that this load control packet set at low data rates really clobbered the unicast data packets at high data rates. By the same token, in this graph, we showed what is the impact if we use if we bring information from the nearest point in the network. And so what we see is that even with single packet detection, we are able to increase the capacity of the network by the fact that we are now using storage as the bandwidth of the network. So the lessons learned from this example is that we better think of some routing scheme that is built on regions of interest And we better start taking a look at how we use storage as the new bandwidth of wireless networks. Another point, this is a quick point to relate to the previous panels, that is less filling of case grade kind of thing, basically scheduling versus contention-based access. We argue that looking at the right contention-based access, but there is much to be gained by scheduling. And this is just my point here is not about scheduling or contention-based access. My point here is that there is a lot to be gained by simulations. Just because we don't have the exact physical layer doesn't mean that the insight we gain from simulations is not really good. Even if the physical layer is not that precise, there is no way that the difference between the simulation results that we obtain and the physical results that we will obtain with the system will be dramatically different. So, in closing, before I turn the floor to the real ideas of the panel, I want to open the discussion by my wish list of the important things that I think would be nice to have in theory. And one is we need to seek theoretical results in the logic, the limits, and performance of algorithms and protocols, because we cannot live with incorrect protocols to begin with. We need to know whether we're doing the right thing. Now we know we shouldn't be fighting interference, we should be embracing interference, so limits are important. We know, and we need to know about the performance of our things. One thing I wanted to hear more about was about the role of simulations and analytical modeling, because they go hand in hand. My wish list of theoretical results is more and more we see the need to understand better the physical layer impact, and the reason is that there are many parameters to tweak, and just doing simulations on doing testbed field experiments is not going to do it, because there are just too many things and takes a lot of time to go through the parameters. Cross-layer interaction, not even optimization, but it's clear that the physical layer, MAC, and routing interact a lot, and also the transport layer. So we need to model that as well. The third point is basically it's one thing to talk about the capacity of networks, but another thing is to think about the capacity of networks or performance of protocols once we play constraints on what the nodes actually can have, because it takes effort to bring the state to the nodes, and different nodes will have different view of the system. So what is the performance that we expect by having limited information? And I guess John was the one who brought this up in the morning. We talked about SDRs, but the truth is that we have the radios used for Wi-Fi are $2 now. So rather than talking about software-defined radios and all that, why don't we just have nodes that have 20 or so radios, or 30 radios? It's not that going to be that expensive. If we do that, right, I'm talking about multiple access protocols based on a single radio. We can talk about some coordinating function that controls a whole bunch of radios that access different channels. Whether or not they are frequency agile, it doesn't really matter. But we still don't have answers that are conclusive, saying this is what you do. This is the way to go about multiple access when you have multiple radios per node. Embracing multiple access interference. Basically, all this time since the packet radio times to today or recently, we have been fighting interference, sending packets over a single path, sending one copy of the packet, pretending that we have Ethernets in the sky and that the receiver can only understand one packet. But with frequency hopping and multiple radios, we can pretend at least that we have our OFDMA. We can pretend we have. Multi-packet reception, multi-packet transmission, and that changes the game. And last but not least, I think we need more theoretical results on what happens when we use storage and processing as the new bandwidth of the network. And I'll take some pre-questions or questions, and then I'll pass the talk.
Thank you. Yeah, just to make it a little bit more controversial.
Okay.
without taking sides, of course. So you mentioned, for example, order of Rajah. So the systems, CS systems come always complains that these are asymptotic. These involve huge hidden constants. So in some sense, if you have a network that you can expect that it's going to be a maximum of 50 or 100 nodes, what's the point of giving me an order of Rajah that whose rate of convergence you don't even know, so the result is going to be relevant once I have 10 million nodes. So why should I care if this network will never have more than 100 nodes? I'm just giving an example. And the other, also along the same lines, if you want to compare a couple of protocols, whether X is better than Y, they might have exactly the same performance in theory because the constants are like 1 and 10 million. Okay. So I guess that one of the things that I would be interested also to figure out is there are different mathematical tools, but we should also think which tool to apply in which network understudy, let me put it this way.
Yeah.
So that to make, and I'm not saying it, I'm just using this as an example, I'm not saying it for a, so maybe you might want to.
Okay, so I'll
maybe the rest of the guys will have it.
So I'll take a stab. So one thing I like about the order results is that if I can show that some result scales with the number of nodes in the network, at the very least I can hope to have some implementation that will scale with the density of the nodes or the neighborhood size. So for example, the same, if I say that like with multi-packet reception and transmission, I can increase the order capacity of the network, it means that in a practical instantiation, even if I cannot fill the transmission space of a receiver or a transmitter with all the possible transmissions in that space, at least I have some subset of those neighbors. That's far better, I think, than shooting for a result that gives me a constant increase of 2 or 3. Because a constant increase of 2 or 3, I should be able to meet that with some source coding, perhaps, or some other clever games. So I would always go for some result that points me to the fact that if you do things right, you can get some log n, where log n is the number of your neighborhood size. You can get a log n advantage. I would always go. The same that the CSMA paper said, if you do the right, the ideal kind of sensing, you get 90% of the use of the channel versus a lot. And it was clear that you do not have magic hacks, but I mean the point was pretty much the same. So I don't think one thing. Anybody wants to comment?
I thought it was
better for questions. I have a question for you, right? I mean, you know the holy grail in software engineering is how to link formal models with performance models. The research in this, and I'm talking about even if we argue that we can reduce all these problems to software engineering, the problem of linking formal analysis, okay, models with performance models is unsolved, even after intensive research in 96 that it was first defined. And we're talking about just software engineering. So now we want to put that with the additional logical or other constraints that come from physical layer and other implementations. Do you have any good idea about how to go about it? Because this is what it's coming down to. I mean, I agree with you with the categorization of logic, performance, and limits. But I hope you agree that they have to be conformal with each other. Okay, in other words, that the formal models have to correspond to corresponding performance models and vice versa. And we're trying to do that, and it's extremely, extremely difficult. Even if you do it at pieces of the whole software that constitutes a network. And I have another one for you, right? Which is even harder. People want to do that under compositionality constraints because, as you do in logic analysis, you're going to have correctness by design issues, right? So I want to have protocol A and protocol B. They have some properties. I want to put them together, and I want to guarantee their properties without doing it from scratch.
Yeah.
And I'll try to do that while you're maintaining the logic and the performance curve.
Yeah.
Have you tried
so,
to come close to this problem?
Since I cannot answer either question, I'll try to say something else.
Okay.
So one thing that would help is if I know what can be separated, basically no matter how much I want to integrate the file with the Mac, I know this can be separated. If I can determine that would be great.
Okay.
Then the other thing is the same way that we have been struggling with the protocol stacks, why don't forget about the stacks and just have basically an idea of, we have some context base for the nodes, and we just have protocol modules. And then how we play with the protocol modules is based on research on what you were mentioning. Having said that, I have no idea how to attack this problem.
I think that's where we are going, but I can tell you we've been struggling for 4 years and we've made a little bit of progress, but it's really hard.
But so I think it's if we keep doing stacks, it's going to be... Okay. Go ahead.
I have a comment on what Costa asked. I think people, oftentimes I see this misconception between what is useful versus the context. So I think in the same spirit that Kamin was just saying, I think all theoretical results are useful, but people always, very often, think useful means that it toasts my bread and cleans my dishes. Okay, so
what do you say in the previous sentence?
Oh, I'm saying people, when they say useful, that means it can toast bread and clean dishes. No, I think some very beautiful results are useful in specific contexts. So order results, I think perhaps you can say it enhances our understanding. And there's this innate desire to understand the structure, and the present day technology may not say anything.
You don't have to convince me, no. But there are a lot of people in this room that they would disagree. I'm sure there are definitely a lot of people not this. You know, you don't have to convince me. I agree that all the results
but
are.
I think that's what it is. And in particular, I think order results, and when you have small scale systems, it can be completely misleading because the constants can flip
But it's not just a constant. The thing is, some order results are only valid for n bigger than n naught. Suppose you will never be there in this region. What's the point of even using this as a scaling law? It's a scaling law of something that doesn't even exist. So again, I'm not saying I like a lot of these results, actually, most of these results, not all. But what I would like to be discussed is exactly the same lines of the previous panel where we said it's not what is useful, but experimental result is useful. Any experimental result, it's always useful, but we should check the lifetime or whatever. You know. So something similar like any theory result is useful, I agree, but we should try to study when it is valid and what it's really saying to us. Sometimes it says something really important. Sometimes it doesn't say something really important.
There was perspective.
What here and
there. Yeah, I'm just going to give like, you know, I call myself an engineer. I'm going to give you an engineer's perspective on theoretical results. You know, but when we, you know, theoretical work, there's so many assumptions in there, you know. It's like not just the scaling net, the scaling factor N, it's also interference models, it's also workflow. And none of them, when I look around networks, like none of them actually are true exactly. And at which point I kind of lose sight. You know, like, is it really important to this result that the workflow be this way, the graph be this way? So I really don't know how to actually think of the result as a really, really, really loose upper bound, or whether I should think of it like something practical, or does it have any implication of
what? Well, I guess the question is, should you even think about it?
Well,
I mean, what you're saying, it's not really something for you to look at.
It's
a paper that's meant for others to look at. Maybe something will come up with that you should look at, but maybe in itself, it's something that's in a context that's just so divorced from.
So we had a comment here.
Personally, I like theoretical results that give you an insight into a new way of doing things. So, for example, in the big O results, I like the idea that, well, if you can do cooperative, hierarchical calculations, then you will improve the capacity of the network. And then the actual details, the constants, do not really matter. But then you can try, right, with three work. So it gives you a new way of thinking. And I think that's what you were saying. If
so
you can do cooperative detection, you do much better than if you. So I think that the value of the theoretical result is more in the insight than in the numbers that we provide. That is a fine, like dot coding of shadow, right? Or like the TCP understanding of cables, you understand why it works, and then you can improve it. So for me, that's what I like.
So
one,
the
yeah, I just
wanted
to make a comment. I've been in a senior discussion where people discuss about theory and practice, and there is a way of testing how useful is a theoretical result besides the fact that you pr- provides insight, which is, you know, there are a lot of assumptions under which the result is derived, but how much the result degrades if you, you know, change the assumption, if the assumptions you are relying on are not critical to observe the same trend, then I think the theoretical result passes some greater test of, you know, being useful, as opposed as a theory that relies on truly unrealistic assumptions and breaks down catastrophically as soon as you, you know, move from that range. And then in that case, I think that the result is not that useful.
Yeah, I think I want to draw an analogy almost with something that from the previous panel where Atul put up a slide where he said, look, when you present experimental results, it's very important that you really look at the applicability of the results. Right? And I think that's something that the authors really have to take responsibility for, saying, look, we only ran experiments at 2 megabits per second, this may not apply at 11 or whatever. And I don't think we experimental people do too much of that or enough of that. In some sense, I think we have a similar issue here, which is if you get theoretical results, what's really the applicability? Because that's had a lot of impact on the result. You know, what's the insight, right? Is there an insight? Typically, it's going to be limited to a particular domain. And it's not always obvious when you read the paper or look at the formulas what that is, because it changes some of the assumptions, right? So kind of bringing that out, I think, is important.
The issue of reproducibility applies in a way also in theory results. I mean, we find very often results that are, you know, I don't have too much problem if the assumptions are clearly explicitly stated before, then it's, I mean, people know exactly what it is for. Very often they are hidden in the development, in the proofs, where the approximations, and sometimes they can completely change the results. And in a way, the claim is more general than what it is, and it can be misleading. And very often it is on that. In scaling laws, typically, the concern of the robustness versus assumptions is that people get, essentially, it's a result which it scales as one of a square root of n or so on. But you change one assumption, and then you have a new scaling laws, and that can be a weakness in a way in this result. So, and sometimes this is well hidden. I mean, it's tedious or a tiny detail in proof which matters a lot. It's an approximation that, and so if it is explicited really before, it makes things much more solid than if it is just an approximation and then the next paper finds that, you know, you change this and you have a gallery of results which all depend strongly on assumptions that are seen on far away from each other. Mm-hmm. I think that's really my point.
I can just
answer
my
Okay. So let's go to
Okay, so there are a few very short comments. It's the thing with a panel like this, when you have a bunch of theoreticians on this, you probably hear the same thing from all of us. So first, a random thought. It might have actually been more interesting to have a panel about what's a useless theory result. It's more lively, but I won't go on to that. So I also thought about, you know, what does it mean to have a useful theory? And I think some of my answers to this are going to be similar to what JJ just said. One class of theoretical results are those that provide understanding of existing systems. I think there's examples like in TCP or in looking at 802.11 where, you know, the systems came first and then the theory came second and sort of explained what the protocols did. And this is useful in setting parameters and also in sort of evolving these standards and just giving some insight. I think another batch of theory, which probably doesn't happen enough, is theoretical results that actually sort of reduce the body of knowledge. And this is, I don't remember the exact quote, but when I was in grad school, I remember Bob Gallagher saying that, you know, that he thought this was the role of theory, was actually not to expand the body of knowledge, but to shrink it. So some theories give new solutions to known problems. So there's, say, we've been hearing problems about, you know, MAC protocols and things that don't work properly, so a theoretical result might suggest a new algorithm. But there's also theories that just suggest new problems, and sometimes these are actually more interesting. And finally, there's theoretical results that provide fundamental limits. So these provide capacities or benchmarks in some sense. And as Mike mentioned this morning, there's different notions of capacity too. This could be in the context of various types of models. And finally, there's this class of theoretical results which provide insight into a problem. And the way I think about what does it mean to provide new insight, it's really showing something that's counterintuitive and making it intuitive. Of course, they're the next generation of researchers. And I think this is what some of these scaling laws and other things are trying to do. Timescale. So we've talked about the role of timescales in networks. I think there's also timescales in usefulness of theoretical results. So some results are immediately useful. They apply to a current system. Some results take a very long time before it's apparent that they're useful. And it's very hard to judge that when you're developing them right now. And I think that's where sort of your comment about theoreticians trying to... I agree that they should be looking at how useful the results are to practice, but practice today and practice in 20 years are very different. Practice in 20 years is much harder to validate today. So I think this is a challenge. And that's, I guess, my second point here, is sort of the long timescale usefulness is not always apparent. It depends on technology trends. It depends on what's infeasible today might be feasible in the future. And the applications, of course, in the future may be different. And finally, I wanted to make a few comments about models. So I think everybody agrees all theory is based on simplified models, and sort of echoing something that John said earlier is, in a sense, models are I would say even 90% of it. They're much more important than what you do with the model. And this is, even I would say among some people that do theory, it's probably not appreciated enough. And I'm including metrics or sort of what you're optimizing as part of the model. So maybe the right question for the panel is what are useful models? I thought about that a little. I don't have an answer for it. I think you sort of know it when you see it. So this is a paraphrase of one of these Supreme Court justices said about pornography at some point. You didn't know what it was, but you know it when you see it. But theory is sort of similar.
Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't.
Models are often
So the corollary is that any useful theory is based on models that are unrealistic to some degree. And I think that's true. And these comments here, I think, are sort of echoing some of the points that were just made. This is, in fact, a good thing if it's done in the right way. And that is that one should try to come up with stylized models that are well-defined, that isolate specific effects, and that have assumptions that are clearly safe. And the advantage of that is then you know what assumptions are causing the results that you see in your models. Muddled theory is where you can't tell what assumptions are causing the effects that you're seeing. And also, another corollary is this shouldn't be an excuse to do work on any unrealistic model. Okay, that's not what I'm saying. But there's this tension and balance, and this is where probably theoreticians should be talking to experimentalists and systems people more, is to try to come up with idealized models that sort of reflect the right concerns. And finally, my last comment in this is along with doing this, I think what's really important in this is sort of an ongoing process of coming up with models, talking to people who are implementing things, refining your models, and closing the loop. Okay, and oftentimes that's maybe gets broke down a bit in practice. But this is somewhere where I think this interplay between practice and theoreticians could happen.
So how does that last bullet point actually happen in academia? I mean, I've seen so few examples of that, and why is it that it doesn't happen more often? I mean, it's definitely easier for you to stay, on pen and paper by yourself, right? And for somebody building systems to almost work in a vacuum as well, why is it that we don't see more of this interplay? Is it just, I mean, it's clearly a cultural issue, but is there something as a community we should do to change the way we do things? I hear this over and over again at workshops. Nobody proposes a solution that doesn't appear to be one. I don't know what you thought.
One other thing, so a related point there I was thinking a bit about earlier is on sort of the cellular side of the world, that connection is much stronger, and it's provided by people like Qualcomm or the labs, and that doesn't seem to be sort of in the loop here. And I don't know. Yeah. Used to be.
Still exists. Yeah. Don't talk it again.
But historically,
you get useful data.
I think they come back, right? Because, I mean, some of the models that we thought were irrelevant, you know, let's say on limited estimation, partially observable channel state information scheduling, maybe in a narrow band channel, sort of was forgotten, and now with cognitive behavior, we will go back. And you and I have talked about like the work that was supposedly a physical.
I'm talking about a very real fact that I can pull out 50 people, and they're literally in, you know, two sets of 25 each that they've never been to the same conference together. They work on topics that are identical to each other. They ought to be citing each other's work, but they don't because they literally sit in different worlds. It completely boggles my imagination. But I know of these communities, and I can, you know, list these people, and some of you are here together today, but. But in general, it doesn't
So I have a comment that doesn't exactly give the solution. So I think when a model is initiated, to say no prior, direct prior work, and I think probably you find theoreticians actually talk to practitioners and to get the very basic, you know, motivation for coming. But I think what happens is this model takes on a life of itself. Then essentially, I think a big part of it, well, for certain percentage of the community, they take published work as a form of validation of the model, and that substitutes for actually talking to the practitioner, right? And then certain models, certain work, instantaneously creates a huge following, then this thing is, you know.
Something like to create this sort of directed graph of just citations to each other, and you literally find sort of this very weak linkage between two, you know, subgraphs in there.
Yeah.
So there's also within, you know, the work that you cite, there's typically a sort of a very narrow view of what is the relevant work. Sometimes I think it's also.
Okay, I think practically to achieve that, we have to be willing to have venues where we have sort of separate but equal but collaborative. So without offending too many people, I think IPSN is a classic example where the initial idea was a good one, but one community ended up taking over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an inability to bridge some of these cultural issues. And when the possibility of having potentially separate but semi-equal ways of evaluating, but having the evaluation be joint, we could not get past that point, which I think is unfortunate because that was potentially a unique place where theory and practitioners were going to be in the same place. It's single track.
I'll give you a simple answer from my life, which is only partial. The best way we have been able to do that, and I will admit it's only about 85% of the time, is when we work clearly with an industry that has a real interest in advancing their products. But I admit that this is not covered in some of the theory that they are far ahead or so on and so forth. But then we found some very interesting collaboration that allowed us to take some theoretical results, and which in the beginning they were even viewed to be impossible for practitioners, and make them into practical systems because we were able to work side by side. I don't know how easy to replicate that.
But this also goes back to the comment in the previous panel about papers being rejected because they were too specific on hardware or ad hoc committees and tenure review are all like that. Oh, this is not my particular type of CS, so it cannot be any good, or things like that. So, I mean, we do it ourselves too. We keep the different disciplines separate.
Yes and no. I mean, it's actually, if you raise the bar a bit and you say that tenure is going to depend if you can do and versus or, meaning you do theory and you do practice, as some very best universities do, then it's a different story.
Yeah.
But then again, we cannot apply this in general, because it's nearly impossible to allow it for this to happen in almost every university. It doesn't. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Oh, so good.
That's fine.
Oh, sorry. I thought you would.
No problem. I've got this session title in front of me, and I feel quite depressed. That says, force me to do a very critical self-examination. And then I think of the bright, sunny California where I used to be, and think, you know, what would my mentors back at Stanford would say? For example, I was co-advised by Stephen Boyd and Tom Cover. You know, I'm putting words in their mouth. Stephen might say that, yeah, theory is useful, it's useless, so what? And Tom may be very confused by the need to discuss theory being useful or not. Useful theory, huh? And then some of my friends in venture capitalists may say, no, don't feel bad about yourselves. You guys are doing great. You know, when we fund 100 proposals with many, many millions of money, about 9 of them fail. About 9 of them sort of do okay, then we bail out. And then one did very, very well, right? So in that regard, NSSI, CCF, let's say, is doing very well, right? You know, a theory changing the world in some small way is just almost like two college dropouts in a garage turning out to be Google co-founders. It's a small probability event, and we shouldn't feel too bad about it. Then I thought about Professor Tom Kyleth, who was my advisor, but I took his class, and then at the end of the lecture, he said this, which I think he was quoting somebody else, that there's nothing more practical than good theory. So I was a student, I got very happy. Then, a few years later, I started thinking more about this, saying, huh, maybe this is actually a definition of a good theory, in which case I haven't done any good theory. So I wasn't sure if I should be happy or not. So I tried to draw a diagram and bring myself to a bit more critical self-examination. It's very self-explanatory. The blue dots are the blue arrows are the ones that are very well done. The red ones are the more problematic ones. So let me say one point in each of the modeling theory and transfer. So I guess we are always torn as theoreticians between relevance and tractability. Almost surely that everything we can prove is irrelevant, and things that are relevant we cannot prove. So what? Of course, you have to prove things we can prove, right? I mean, you have to end a paper with a theorem. So you try to stretch it a little bit at the introduction part, and the conclusion part. I mean, that applies mainly for myself only. So we are quite torn. We're torn between the good days and the bad days, but that's fine. We have to realize we are working not really on the engineering problem, but on the mathematical crystallization of the problem. And there's nothing wrong with that. But as Patrick was saying, that it would be nice if every paper has a section clearly marked as assumptions and a bullet list of assumptions. Some more reasonable, some may not so reasonable for this day on this particular system. And then maybe in the future work part, we can try to have a subsection talking about the robustness with respect to these assumptions. Sometimes there's nothing we can say. It says, if you drop this assumption, nothing holds in this paper. So please take that assumption, right? but that's explicit and it's clear and it's consistent across the field. Then that's perfectly fine, I think, right? So on the modeling part, I think there is a way to do that. It's just to say the assumptions loud to everybody, because theory can only be as good as the assumptions. And all assumptions, by that very word, means you are throwing away part of reality. That it is incomplete, and therefore all theories are incomplete. All papers on theory are incomplete. That's fine. We'll just say it, how incomplete it is. And then once transported into the model and the theory part, I guess one thing theoreticians can be really good at is, as Gallagher always advocates, to trim the knowledge tree rather than grow it. That we can write papers that can kill other future papers. And these papers are usually very insightful ones. So for example, these reverse engineering results that not only describe but also explains existing protocols under certain assumptions, of course. And that's transforming a lot of layer 2 and above networking from 19th century biology to 21st century biology, or from biology in the traditional sense to physics, because human memory is too short. We cannot afford to describe every single protocol and every user manual. But if you have certain quote-unquote laws that explains the phenomena, then it's a much more concise representation, much shorter description length for future generations to remember. We're also good at trimming trees if we, say, try to derive rather than to describe the whole protocol stack. Because, again, human lifespan is too short. Trial and error and tuning the knobs in that way may just take too much time. We have infinite lifespan, probably doesn't matter. But deriving rather than describing protocol stack is also another way to trim the trees. And then if you do transfer, I think that would be wonderful, but it's very, very hard. And it takes a lot of time to reach out beyond the comfort zone. I don't think that we need everybody in the theoretical community to do that. But every now and then, somebody doing that is doing great service to everybody, especially to the theoretical community. And complexity of your algorithm usually is what the practitioners would object to. So I've been brought down to ground many times through my industry collaborations, like in the cellular area with Qualcomm, with Marvell, with Nokia Siemens. And any time I say something, they say that it doesn't matter what you say next because it doesn't hold or because the complexity is too much. I said, well, it's polynomial time, but they say, huh. So, you know, that complexity in the practical setting is something that I've always been brought down to earth by my industry practitioners. So I really hate talking to them and try to avoid talking to them as much as I can. But talking to them every now and then really refreshes my mind quite a bit. And that helps with transferring the great insights from this side of the world to that side of the world. So I think in general, there is a chance for the theory community to move this black bar from the right to the left. I should draw animation, but I don't know how to do the animation well, so I'll give up on that. So imagine this black bar moving from right to left. Again, not everybody needs to do that, because we all need a certain compartmentalization, a certain boundary of what we do every day, so that we can be the same. But if somebody occasionally moves that bar a little bit further to the left, that's very helpful. That examines the crystallization process critically, that trims the tree based on that, and then try to do a little bit of transfer by talking to industry people. And, for example, cellular is a good example that there are real industry, and some of them are actually very, very smart. So let me conclude with another picture. And try to end with a positive tone, that there's theory and practice, and I think in addition to bridging the gap, there's actually a good chance for synergy. If you look at the overlap, I've amplified the overlap out of scale by a lot. Okay, it's not like 10% overlap, it's much smaller than that. But just to make everybody feel better in the theory community, let's say it's a pretty big overlap. But nonetheless, it is not the whole theory side, and it's not the whole practice side. We'll always stay that like that forever. So now we have a choice. We can either keep digging the same hole on the theory extreme left or the practice extreme right, or we can try to do one of these three things. One is try to increase the overlap. By that, I mean invent new mathematical machinery. These are really fundamental theoretical contributions that allow us to prove things we couldn't prove before. So that the overlap becomes bigger because of the mathematical machinery, the language becomes richer. Or we can raise new questions based on new insights. And everybody lives in a bigger space, and sometimes the overlap also just naturally increases a bit. Or somebody maybe can do them both. And there are such occasional cases. So these three things will all take a lot of time, and we can't hope to do them all the time. I've done almost nothing like any of these three. But it's a lofty goal to be aspired to, and I think that would be much better than each camp digging the same hole in wherever they are situated. So I think there is such a hope. And I'll conclude with that more positive tone.
Comments?
I thought that was a positive tone.
You left us a hope. I guess I have a question for the panel. So in this fundamental question between theory and practice, I guess most of us are either engineers or computer scientists here, or systems in computer science. How would you contrast some of the things you said versus, say, a mathematician that's looking at, you know, applications of mathematics versus the theory of fundamental mathematics?
Right, right. So I think mathematicians enjoy a luxury that are handy because they don't claim to be engineers. And they don't even claim to be scientists. So they don't claim to either invent new things or to understand nature. But instead, they say we are mathematicians. You know, we're a different breed of human beings. That we are playing games with very simple Islamic rules. But the implication of these very simple rules are so interesting, so fascinating, that human society need to pay these people to play games. And it's really good for, rather than spending the money on some other things in the society. So I think they can afford to say that, I don't care. And I guess sometimes certain members of our community, some very distinguished member, who actually hold joint appointments in statistics, in mathematics, they sometimes actually are saying that I'm here to play interesting games. I think it's fun. It turns out sometimes it's actually useful. Oh, all right, I'm ashamed, but what can I do? So I think they have that luxury. And if we write a paper and claim that, even in the E department, as long as the department chair don't talk to me about that, then I think that's okay. I think the confusion arises, especially for future generation of the students, is when some assumptions are dropped from explicitly being mentioned, like in some of my papers, or the introduction sort of tries to claim a bigger potential impact than it actually is, again, like my papers, then I think that may lead to a little bit of confusion, especially the students who actually think that there is a one-one correspondence directly from the theory to that practice. So I think as long as we make it clear and explicit, then that's fine. Although I don't think that engineers, as engineers, we can really afford to do that. But if we do that, I think that's better than not even doing that part. So back to a question I guess you asked, it's a very simple question, I gave a long one-end answer, is that mathematicians are a different breed. I think they can afford to do many things that engineers just cannot claim to be doing and still claim themselves to be engineers.
But they can still ask the question, what's good theory? Right.
Say that again? What's a good theory from a mathematician's point of view? Or?
What's good theory, right?
Good theory or useful theory? So this could be a definition. Although I don't think it should be the only definition of a good theory. But it could be used as one of the definitions of a good theory. So that something that makes tremendous practical impact is a good theory. It's a shame that I don't know how to sign this because I don't know who said this first. But I think
it was Einstein, or by a version of that, it is in the book for Einstein.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Because he can imagine why, because his theory had profound impact.
Sure.
But by his own admission, his mathematics were lousy to answer your question. But it was with his mathematics.
Right. So, the good theory question, I think this could be a definition of that. But I don't think it should be the only definition.
But I want to answer your question by quoting two famous applied mathematicians, right? The one is Poincaré, and if you come to my room, you will see I have it on behind my chair, because it says, mathematics can only tell you what if, not what is. Right? And then the other one is by Paul Hamel, okay, who said that to be a good mathematician, pure mathematician, is much easier than being a good applied mathematician. So as a network person, you should feel more close to the applied mathematician, because you have to be really a jack of all trades, right, to do good work. And that's very difficult.
Interesting anecdotal, if you go to Princeton, to the building that hosts mathematics and applied mathematics guys, and you look at the, correct me if this changed over the last couple of years, but it used to be like that a few years ago, the names of the faculty of the mathematics department font sizes are twice the size of the font sizes for the faculty that apply to
if you multiply the size of the letter by the number of mathematicians and mathematicians, I think you're going to get a constant. But I wish Montian was right as far as mathematicians can afford to do that. Not anymore.
Not anymore?
They're getting less and less of
them. Not even at Princeton?
Oh. Well, you, how many mathematics faculty do
you have? Six
I think it's quite a lot, but anyway, I think they still enjoy a little bit more luxury than we do, but maybe diminishing.
Okay, hi there. I feel in the wrong panel, because you might think I'm a theorist. Let's give you some background, or maybe I should say assumptions. Actually, I'm a systems guy. I like to do experimental work and learn from that. I'm interested in sensor networks, as it happened to be. We like to play with a lot of things. So you can see 100 nodes standing at the edge of the field waiting to be deployed. So if you think sensor networks is about aesthetic things, you're wrong. They do move because people tend around to shuffle sensors wherever they like. So what kind of research do I do? MAC protocols, that fits well with this audience. Localization, finding back where your stuff is. That's actually quite useful. Even finding back of theorems might be actually useful. And I like to do deployments, as I already mentioned. So for some reason, I hooked up with people doing agricultural stuff. I know a lot about potatoes. I've learned about potatoes in the last 3 years. Maybe you should save that for dinner time. Anyway, they grow, and you can put sensors next to them and start measuring stuff. I'm interested in the networking aspect, of course. So what do you learn if you actually go out there and try to build something and see what happens? Well, you might recognize this guy. He's called Murphy. That's because I wrote this paper, Murphy Loves Potatoes. It's incredible how many mistakes you can make in try to get a sensor network up and running and try to get some data out. So the first year around, the numbers up there, I got 2% of all the measured data we actually got through the network, multi-hopping to the edge of the field where you could actually save it. And we found a lot of bugs, right? So that's why I said 89% of the bug here. Next year is, of course, situation improve, and that's because we cheated. We go to a single cell, which is much easier to do, right? But nobody cares. Farmers want data. So what did I learn? That's this nice quote by a fellow Dutchman. In theory, there is no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there is. So there are some more fundamental things that you can learn, and basically the software crisis. We don't know how to put together software that fits into tiny computers and does a lot of things. Part of the reason is that we like to develop software or hardware design and test methodology. We just put things together, we put them in certain circumstances, fix bugs until everything works. Well, if you think of wireless sensor networks, you have the wireless domain. We all know it's quite random wherever you go, so that's a source. And then we want to talk about tiny sensors, so we have many of them. So getting a 100-node network in one configuration, observing what the problem is, putting the code patch in, and then getting that network exactly the same configuration, no way. Right? So basically, design and test, not going to work. So that's why I think we could use some some theory or some more formal approach. This is a cry for help for some of you in the audience. Right? So we know about the two different worlds, theory, practice. I decided to become a customer of theory, so let's see if you have something to offer. All right, so what could I use? Correctness proofs, you already mentioned that. I have an idea, I code it up, and now I want to know what's going to happen. Did I code it up right? Preferably take a high-level language and do automatic code generation. Correctness proofs, I think I'm in the wrong audience. There's a whole bunch of other theoreticians out there. But okay. More closer is what I think is valuable is bounds. Whenever we come up with a particular protocol, we evaluate it, and now we want to know how good is it? How far are we off the theoretical limit? So whatever bounds you can give me, I like to get as close as possible. And then, of course, there are a lot of algorithms developed for topology control and whatever. I would like to take some of those algorithms and use them in my systems. Okay. So maybe you can serve one of those bullets. Come and talk to me after the panel. Right.
How much are you offering?
In theory, potatoes.
We have bronze, which is 1 kilo. Okay, so the picture shows you that two dimensions that I think are important. The level of detail, so you carry out one particular practical deployment, you get a lot of details, but that gives you only one data point. So we refer to simulations to do a bit of exploration, what's happening if we would double the number of potatoes or double the number of nodes or whatever, right? And then if you go to the far left, that's where you have your theoretical results that holds whenever, right? There's just one big N and that's it. If you look at the system size, in practice we can handle one, maybe two deployments in a lifetime, that's it for me, right? Then I retire and somebody else can take over. Simulations, you can manage much larger scale systems. In theory, you can have N go up to, maybe you say 100,000, whatever, right? So I think that's part of the power of theory, is that you can span a large scale. Some of the theory doesn't get farther than one, right? If you think about correctness proofs and talk about model checking, for example, you're already happy if you get one system that you can say something reasonable about, right? But a lot of theory, or some theory, all get up all the range. Okay, so that's, from the practical point of view, that's why I usually go to the left, but I stop in simulations. Maybe we should go one step further. Okay, let's see what we can offer. So I would like to get algorithms and use them, and then that turns out to be a problem because of the constraints, the assumptions that do not hold in my territory while sensing network. So there are some details that do matter, and a lot of algorithms that I've seen out there don't match them. So first of all, sensor networks is interesting because we're talking about energy. It was mentioned once or twice, but in sensor networks, if there's a paper, no energy results, I just don't read it. Right? That's me, but energy is important. Counting the number of messages gets you somewhere. Right? The other thing is a state, memory footprint. It sounds reasonable that you know who your neighbors are. Okay, but if you're working with a tiny device and you have 100 neighbors, you don't want to maintain elaborate state, right? So we had this discussion somewhere, one of the panels. If I'm sending you an RTS message, I know who you are, so I can compute a schedule. Well, I know about a few neighbors. I don't care in everybody else. So there's not a way that I can compute a max schedule by knowing 3 out of 100 neighbors, right? Knowing 3 neighbors is good enough to get my data to the sink or wherever I want to. Okay, so cost is one particular metric that is different than in a lot of other worlds. Communication is very important because that's what I like to do. An important point is that unicast has fundamentally different properties than broadcast. Okay. One of the things is that we looked at different MAC protocols. And the important message from the picture is that the curves look really different. So what it says is that the ratio of the cost, energy-wise, unicast versus broadcast. Right, so some MAC protocols, it doesn't matter. The line on the top, the red one, the MAC, if you send out a unicast message or a broadcast, you pay the same price. Other protocols have been carefully engineered to do well in the domain of unicast. Right? There's a very low cost for, say, which is that one wise MAC on the bottom. So, whenever you give me an algorithm, tell me what you do. Do you use unicast? Do you use broadcast? I need to know. And then there's the question of whether you have reliable communication. Yes or no. We can make it reliable by doing retransmissions, doing multipath routing, all kinds of interesting games, but you pay the price. Right? And a lot of algorithms that I've seen, that they implicitly assume that we have reliable communication. Or we do have reliable broadcast even. I send out a message and all my neighbors now know my state. Well, that's not going to happen in my world. Unreliable, that's for free. That's what we always can offer.
Just to maybe add something to this, I guess you're talking about not just link losses, but also the fact that nodes are going to sleep.
Sure.
Reliability is not just because of...
Some of the very efficient MAC protocols intentionally don't listen to all the traffic. They try to avoid as much traffic as possible. So sending out a broadcast message in that domain is very difficult because you do have to repeat it sending. If you have 100 neighbors, you don't want to do that. Last bullet that I want to say something is that algorithms quite often are expressed in rounds. We do... the leader election and try to form some kind of hierarchy in a large network, round one, round two, and you count the number of rounds. If one message got lost, somebody is not playing his part and the whole thing collapses. And we can't put in a lot of things. You saw Bhaskar's slide on trying to make things practical, but maybe we should from design algorithms from day one with knowing that communication is going to. Okay, knowing that, it's always good to have a look at what's happening out there. So one of my students went through a bunch of proceedings looking for theoretical papers, looking even at systems conferences and seeing whether and those people would actually pay attention to those points that I just mentioned. So these are the violations, right? So 61% of the theory papers that we looked at assumed there was reliable communication. I can only have to read 40% of the papers, so that's the good news, right? 61% of the papers and did not do any kind of accounting for energy or communication for that matter. And 25% of the papers did these round-based synchronous style operation, right? These are, on the bottom you can see where we got the conferences from, so IPSN and DCOS. I mean, they're pretty well respected in our field. And the systems people, they take more credit of those issues and they have less papers. But still, 40% of the papers, I mean, this is sensor networks, they don't talk about energy. Right? So the good news is that these people got their papers published in well-established conferences, right? So you can get away with it. But for me, if you would convince me this is super viable, then please pay attention. So that's my last slide, is some advice. What I would like to see is that please take care of those things. So unreliable communication. Have a look at the correctness of the algorithm. If one message fails, I can pick out the one that's screwing up. Also stability. Some algorithms, they just get into one corner and they never get out of it again, right? So we would like to avoid that. Performance, obviously. I think it's very important to count the number of messages and actually tell the difference between unicast and broadcast, because that's a huge difference at the MAC level. And finally, that's the, instead of using synchronous round-based protocols, use reactive protocols. I get a message in, I do something, and you can still construct a leader election using this style of methods.
Okay. Again, we have time for one or two?
Yes, we have 5 minutes.
5 minutes? Oh, then. Three or four.
Is advice to make a useful theory?
Sorry?
Is this advice to make a useful theory or advice in general?
It's an advice so that I can actually benefit from that theory on the short term. Right? These are my constraints today, and I think unreliable communication is going to stay there for a long time, so some of those constraints will hold for a longer time, for sure. So,
I guess maybe it's a side question, but given that I think this community is becoming humongous, I don't have a sense of the size, but it just seems like a big community, and that there are masses of papers being published. Somehow, when you ask the question, what's a useful theory, what comes to my mind is, well, how are people going to find it? It's going to be in this. As a researcher, you have to sort of decide when you stop looking and you start working, and you're always constantly in fear that you're going to miss something, and you're going to be reinventing the wheel. So I guess I'm wondering if you have any comments about that.
I very much agree that that we're approaching, converging to the asymptote of zero time for thinking and writing, and 100% time just to do reviewing, after saying no to most of our friends too. And we're converging to zero money from funding agencies and the number of students. That's not a desirable equilibrium. But I do think that there's a real need to do, if not trimming the tree, at least structuring the tree. Do taxonomy, do community-wide survey article constructions, workshops like this, collective effort, at least to do structuring by providing a taxonomy, without saying which paper is better than which, but at least to see which papers share the same set of assumptions and which actually don't, and therefore not comparable directly, and just build up the intellectual heritage, like in, say, some other community, like information theory, because they grew out of very different historical legacy. They have a structure and taxonomy from day one, which in some sense limits their applicability in other dimensions. But in the dimension of having structures to make the future conversation easier, they do have an advantage. I think a networking community would benefit a lot from such community-wide efforts. I'm not saying that somebody's going to do it or that it can be done. I'm just saying
what would it take? What would it take? We have these Wikipedia, have a wiki on random access protocols, right? Everything you need to know from the very start, that would be incredibly useful.
So that's a fantastic idea, but what is in it for the individual, right? Would you be able to write this on your resume that you contributed 4 articles?
But in terms of Wikipedia,
would you be able to count it as a publication? Will the funding agencies fund, and call it productive work? So the question is, how do we create incentives for these activities?
Advertising?
But the fundamental issue is that it's not so much what can we do, it's how can we create the incentives to do what needs to be done.
But maybe a way to pay for this, incentive is that time wasted. It's like the point that Scott was making, the time wasted not only by us, but maybe more importantly by our students. And I think it's true that what a couple of you have said, it takes quite some time to figure out, especially in time transit right now, from one community to leave another community. And the more I transit, the more I'm confused both about the metrics in the different communities, as well as the amount of papers, what I and the students, many of the students, to read, to know what's what, and how to refer to all of them, and how what is the same and what's different. I remember, for example, reading some papers from a couple of people in the community, in the panel, and wondering, well, this is my crosslayer, this is their crosslayer, the same word crosslayer, and taking time and taking the student's time. So maybe the incentive is that if we do it right, but I'm not sure it's easy to do it right, it's the amount of time that we as future generations...
I mean, my first experience with this was trying to set up a bibliography for wireless sensor networks, and we were able to do it as a group to a group of about 700 to 1,000 papers, and we had to give up because it was... it's this explosion point we can.
But you don't need
as
to do that.
It's not one group, but it's
between individuals, together as a community, creating.
Yeah, I think the wiki idea is.
At least we could also have stalwarts in a particular topic, in a particular area, give talks, at forum, consolidating the work that has been done. So he or she has worked in that area and should be knowledgeable of what has been done. So what has been done, what are the open issues? And that might help.
It sounds like really the work of an encyclopedia. And this is the whole point of an encyclopedia, is to really capture the knowledge in some summarized form that you are able to see the taxonomy, the structure of the field.
Okay.
It's something that is already lacking.
We should develop the taxonomy in the
Well,
thanks to the panel.